is no longer true. So thank you, Mike. 18, when it talks about, and he said to his servant, go up and look towards the sea as the Lord speaking to Elijah. And Terry came up to me. Is Terry here tonight? Oh, there he is. He's in the booth. And he said, and we were talking about Regina's Bible made it sound like it was Elijah's servant that went up, not Elijah. And I don't know why. I've always read that as the Lord talking to Elijah and Elijah going up. And it's not. It was Elijah's servant that went up, not Elijah. It doesn't change the point at all, but I completely blew it, which is why we do things like this. So thank you, Terry, for pointing that out. And I just wanted to make sure to correct that before we got into our study tonight. So bad teacher. All right, going forward, let's go ahead and jump into our discussion for this evening. Go ahead and open up your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 19. And we're going to spend almost the majority of our class in 1 Kings chapter 19. Now, normally, these books that were given, I don't generally follow them very closely. I will say this, though, if you want a copy of the lecture this evening of what's in the book, this is probably one of the best bits of literature I've ever read on a correct biblical perspective on depression and in the lives of Christians. And he does a very good job. His name is Dr. James Dalton. And so if you want a copy of that, I can make a copy of this for you and get it to you after services. Just let me know after we're done with class and I'll get that to you. But the reason we bring that up is because we are going to be dealing with the topic of depression somewhat this evening, because Elijah certainly is an individual who is very depressed when we get to this section of the text in 1 Kings chapter 19. But we're not just going to talk about depression, we're going to talk about discouragement, we're going to talk about feeling isolated or feeling alone and how that impacts our faith, and so we're going to have a lot of in-depth, deep discussion this evening, and hopefully we'll have some good discussion as we have every night so far. But to begin with, we want to go ahead and read the first part of the text. And I want to jump into to this real quick before we do that. I've talked about Randy Powell a couple times. He's the guy that Kylie and I went and saw when we were in Texas. He's the counselor down there in Temple, Texas. And one of the things he talked about, and you can understand this, is that everyone's life is made up of really four areas that can rise and fall. And it's the PIES acronym, which is physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. And I think you can see that in our lives. And what's interesting is that when one of those is suffering, oftentimes one of those, the rest of those are going to be brought down with it. Or when one of those is excelling, it can bring the rest of those up with it as well. Every area of our life is very closely knit and tied together. And we're going to see that in our discussion this evening when we look at Elijah. And the reason we want to bring this up is sometimes this is a very controversial issue. And if you disagree with me tonight, that's great. We can discuss that, especially afterwards. But a lot of times Christians chalk up depression to a faith issue and saying that if you're discouraged or if you feel isolated or if you're depressed, that you have a problem, a spiritual problem, and it's very easily corrected by just trusting God better. You just need to get over it. And I don't think that's what the Bible teaches at all. In fact, when we look at Elijah and the person Elijah was, how many people in here would say that Elijah had a problem with his faith? Or that Elijah was a man that was not full of faith when we look at him as an individual? No one in here would do that, and yet we find Elijah in a very low, low place in 1 Kings chapter 19. In fact, many people that we look at as being tremendously faithful, we find in very low places in their life. We look at David in very low places in his life. We look at Jeremiah at very low places in his life. We look at Ezekiel at very low places in his life. Men that struggled with isolation and discouragement and even perhaps depression. And Christians have got to get over thinking that depression is just something that you have a problem with and that you just need to get over. Because just like the physical body can get sick, the mind can get sick as well, and we need to be able to be patient and treat both of those at the same time. And so we're going to discuss that this evening and how all of these together can be interconnected and affected. We're going to see that in the life of Elijah. But let's start by looking at Elijah and reading this text. Can I get a volunteer to go ahead and read verses 1 through 8 to begin with of 1 Kings chapter 19. Whoever's there, just go ahead and read it out loud.
Ahab told Jezebel that Elijah had died, and so she went out and executed all the prophets of the sword. And Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, so has God
Thank you so much for reading that. When you read this section of text, if you were to read this first and then go back and read 1 Kings 18, you might think you're reading about two very different men, actually, if you don't know anything about Elijah outside of what we've already talked about. Because what a difference we see. We see a man who just a little while ago was standing up before a king and declaring boldly to him the will of the Lord, challenging their false gods, and put to death all the prophets of Baal and Asherah. And yet now, Elijah, when you see where he's at, he is at the lowest point in his life. He's sitting under a tree. He's all by himself. He's isolated. He's terrified. And he's actually asking God, take away my life, because it would be better if I were just not here. Has anyone ever felt like that before or known someone who's felt like that before? That's a very real issue in people's lives today, where people get so discouraged, so depressed, that they don't even think their life is worth living anymore. Elijah is at this point. And I think there's some things that contribute to his perspective and his condition that we're going to see here. Number one is going to be fear. Now let me ask this question. What has changed here? Because when you go back to 1 Kings 18, did Elijah have any fear in meeting Ahab or speaking out to Ahab, who had just as much authority to seek his life and kill him? Did he have any fear of Ahab in chapter 18? I mean, absolutely not, right? What's changed between now and here in 1 Kings chapter 19? Why is he so afraid for his life? Okay, elaborate for a little bit. Why Jezebel? Okay, when you go back to 1 Kings 18, who was the one that actually had put the prophets of the Lord to death? Was it Ahab? Or who was it? It was Jezebel. Jezebel seems to be the one where the real threat lies. Ahab might say, I'm going to take your life, but Ahab hasn't had any guts that we've seen so far. He's had his backbone taken by his wife. Jezebel, when she sends Elijah this message, in Elijah's mind, this is a very real threat that has been issued against him. She is seeking his life, and she's not going to stop at anything until she has it taken, right? He's terrified for his life. And oftentimes, fear in our lives can lead us to lose focus of the bigger picture. Can you think of any other biblical characters in your mind that fear caused them to lose sight of the bigger picture and caused them to be very narrow-minded in that moment? Okay, that's exactly who I was thinking of too. Go ahead and elaborate, Daron.
Well, he obviously knew he shouldn't deny Christ, and he told Christ he wouldn't deny him,
but in the moment, he was definitely afraid of being associated with him. That's exactly right. And even earlier in Peter's life, I had thought about, remember when Peter walks on water towards Jesus, and then all of a sudden, he sees the waves, and he loses focus. Fear caused him to lose focus, and it caused him to take his eyes off of Jesus, and he became afraid, right? So, good. Any other biblical examples of individuals that you can think of that fear caused them perhaps to lose focus in their life? Yes, that's right. God, I know about Paul, or Saul. I know what he's done to your people. He had a very much an Obadiah response, didn't he? Where if you're sending me to him, you're just signing my death warrant, Lord. Why would you do this to me, right? Okay, good, good. Anyone else? Jonah? Jonah's fear wasn't for his life. His fear was that God would show these people mercy. His was a fear of God being merciful and righteous towards a people that he wanted to see destroyed because of his prejudice against them. But this is a very real issue in our lives. Fear can cause us to lose focus, to lose sight of the bigger picture. Not only that, but we also see that Elijah's dealing with isolation. Two things that take place here. Number one, he leaves his servant that I had missed in the text behind, and he's going to go off to himself in the wilderness. He doesn't go to a city where other people are. He doesn't go to a city of refuge or anything like that. He goes out where nobody else is going to be, and he is all by himself. And oftentimes, people that are dealing with fear or discouragement or depression, that's a natural symptom, isn't it? Where people withdraw themselves from other individuals because they feel so isolated. They feel like they're all alone. Whether they are or not, they feel like they are. And this is a very real issue in our lives that we have to deal with. And oftentimes, people feel like they're forced into isolation. Like it's not their choice. That they want to be with people, but they feel isolated. The reason they feel isolated was not their choice. You talk to people who have been raped before. And I remember having a conversation with a young woman just a few weeks ago on Facebook who she was raped 3-4 times growing up. And over again, she felt like so isolated, forced into a position of isolation and loneliness. And that was not her choice. That was something that was impressed upon her. She felt like she was forced into this position. People who get very sick and can't get out or go do things or be around others, oftentimes they feel like they've been forced into a place of withdrawal or isolation. My mind goes to the woman with the discharge of blood. Remember that Jesus heals? She had had that symptom. Do you remember for how long that was? 12 years. She had been to every physician. She had been to every doctor. And she could not get answers. And because of her condition, what was her state according to the law? She was unclean. She could not do almost anything that anybody else can do. Her condition forced her into isolation. And a lot of times that leads to very serious difficulties in an individual's life when they feel that alone. Not only is he isolated, but he feels like he's absolutely hopeless. Did y'all catch his expression in verse 4? I want to ask, what do you think Elijah means when he says that? His motivation behind asking God to take his life is he says, "Take away my life, for I am no better than my father's." What does Elijah mean when he says that? I'm no better than my father's. So take my life away from me. This was a tough one for me. I had to chew on this for a little while. I just want to know what y'all might think. I think that's a very good possibility. That when he looks at what has happened before, all these prophets that had prophesied and spoken the will of the Lord, their voices were silenced, right? They were cut down. And here, in my mind, Elijah thinks we're finally at a turning point, right? I have obviously demonstrated God's power and God's authority over these false gods. We've killed these false prophets. Things are turning around. Does it turn Jezebel's heart at all? No, in fact, it leads to almost the exact same ending that all the other prophets had had. And so, in Elijah's mind, he feels completely and utterly hopeless and useless. Like his job has done nothing. It hasn't turned the people. It hasn't affected anyone. And Jezebel's here. She's going to take his life just like everyone else before him. You know what, God? Just take my life so Jezebel doesn't do it and get the satisfaction for doing it herself. Elijah here feels completely hopeless in his position. And a lot of times, a lot of people feel that way in their lives. And just because we don't understand it does not make it any less real in their lives. People come from places where they are below rock bottom. They feel absolutely hopeless and worthless. And I really feel that that's exactly what Elijah is feeling at this moment. He feels like his life has no worth or value, no purpose, because of what's going on in the nation right now and because of what's about to happen to him or though he thinks. So you combine these three things, a fear for his life, a loss of focus, being isolated, being forced into isolation, running for his life, and feeling like he's completely worthless, that's going to lead anybody to be in a completely disarrayed state and being completely depressed and low. This is the lowest we're going to find Elijah. Doran, do you got your hand up? Right.
I don't think it would have been a lot of time that's passed. And literally, I mean, I know she's wicked and he knows it.
Right. Right. Right, right. And I think that's why the scripture that talks about to the one who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. I think so often in our fragility as humans, in our sinfulness, and also just our weakness in being human, we can go from a high to a complete low so quickly. We so easily forget the power of God or the strength of God to deliver or to help, or the hope that's there, and we can so quickly lose focus like Elijah does. And what's so amazing to me is the way that God's going to respond to Elijah, as we're going to see. He's not harsh with Elijah. He's not hard on Elijah, where he could have been perhaps. He's going to gently bring Elijah back to the place where he's supposed to be and get him back on track to where he's supposed to go. But I mean, I relate to Elijah there, Daron, and I hear exactly what you're saying. Because I look in my lives at times where things were going great, and then immediately I'm down here. And it's like, how did I get there? What happened in that moment? And the only explanation I can come up with is our human nature, our humanness. Yeah. Right.
Because you've been holding fast, you've been working towards something, giving it your all, and then when it ends, there's that natural
question. I think that's right. And I think, you know, he's coming off the high of Mount Carmel right here, right? Yeah, Annette? Right. Right. Well, and Elijah is going to believe some lies that we're going to see. Elijah's lie that he bought full-heartedly, that he believed even at Mount Carmel, is, I am alone. That I alone stand for God. And we're going to see that though he believed that wholeheartedly, that that's actually not a reflection of reality. And oftentimes, in our discouragement and in our depression, we don't have an accurate reflection of reality. And that's why we need others to be so patient and kind towards us and helping us to bring us to a point where we can see that better. But it doesn't happen by just telling someone, you got to get it together, you're wrong. And we're going to see that here with God and with Elijah. And so here, the first thing I want us to recognize, and this is an application for us, is the first thing that God tended to is his physical needs. So if I get, well, we already read that actually. He goes into the wilderness, and God is going to give him a day to just sleep, right? I don't know if y'all are like me. When I'm stressed out, that's what I... Some people, when they're stressed, they eat. Some people, when they're stressed, they don't eat. Some people, when they're stressed, they sleep. That's me, okay? Oftentimes, physical symptoms of discouragement or depression or feeling isolated leave someone to a state like this, where they're restless and they are malnourished. They aren't getting what they need. And instead of God getting Elijah up and saying, you've got work to do, God gives him a day of rest here. And not only that, but he's providing for him physically what he needs before he gets up and goes and does this long journey. He gives him the rest he needs. He gives him the food that he needs. In fact, he doesn't just feed him once. He feeds him twice before he goes on this 40-day journey. And I think there's some application there for us. When we're dealing with someone who's discouraged, or we're dealing with someone who is feeling hopeless, the first step in helping others is not sitting down and hashing out their mental state and trying to fix everything all at one time. Oftentimes, the best thing you can do is to make sure they're safe, is to make sure that they have the things physically that they need in that moment, and taking care of them, getting them in a right state of mind physically, so that way we can then talk about and work on a plan of action and going forward and doing different things from that point. You know, I really respect Journey for what she's doing, because that's something that she recognizes is a great need in a lot of people's life in Crab Origin. So she's going and taking care of people's physical needs with the assistance of many other people. And that's where it starts, is getting people physically taken care of in a safe place, in a good place. All right, now we can go from there. Now we can take the next step. And that's how God deals with Elijah, and that's how God often, I think, wants us to deal with others as well. Any thoughts or comments on that before we move on? I know we're going faster paced tonight because I've been going late each night. So, all right, so let's read on in our text here. And I want to go ahead and read verses 9 through 14 and then also just verse 18. And what we're going to see is God is going to very gently offer Elijah a change of perspective. And he's going to try to encourage Elijah as Elijah is so discouraged. And we're going to see that that discouragement continues even after a period of 40 days of thinking about things and where things are at in his life. And so if I can get a volunteer to read verses 9 through 14 and then skip down and read verse 18. Okay, thank you so much, Jerome. When you look at this, I love the question to Elijah, and I don't think God is asking Elijah, what are you doing here on Mount Horeb? Because the Lord's the one that sent him there, right? What is God asking when he says, Elijah, what are you doing here? What's the Lord's point in asking Elijah this question? Because he doesn't just ask him once. He's going to ask him twice. Elijah, what are you doing here? What's the Lord doing with Elijah here? Okay, he's causing Elijah to reflect, and he's also giving Elijah an opportunity to voice himself, right? He's giving Elijah an opportunity to reflect on his position and where he's at, and the Lord is going to listen to where he's at. Even if it might not be an accurate reflection of reality, God is listening to his hurt, God is listening to his heart, and he asks him, tell me what's going on, Elijah. Why are you here? Why are you in this condition? And so he hears Elijah out, but I think also in doing that, when he revisits this question, he's trying to get Elijah to see a bigger picture. Oftentimes when the Lord asks people a question multiple times, it's usually because their first answer wasn't the right answer, right? Jesus with Peter again, right? Peter, do you love me? Well, yes, Lord, you know I love you. Well, Jesus looks at Peter again. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Peter, do you love me? Peter didn't quite get it, right? And Jesus was gently leading Peter to understand the kind of love Jesus was calling him to have. And here, the Lord is gently leading Elijah, saying, Elijah, you don't belong here. I understand why you're here, but you don't belong here. And so then he does something very peculiar. And I've never really understood this, and so I'm going to give you my best guess, and I'm going to lean on Scott and some others, maybe the elders here, to give us a perspective as to why God does this. But we have this account where he brings Elijah out to the entrance of this cave, and God performs these great, powerful signs. There's this great wind, and I think about, you know, like hurricane kind of force winds. And it says, but the Lord was not in the wind. And then there's this earthquake that takes place then, and it says the Lord was not in the earthquake. And then there was this great fire that took place, but the Lord was not in the fire. And then God comes back, and there's a soft whisper, and that's when Elijah comes back out. And God asks him that question again, Elijah, what are you doing here? What's the purpose of this? Why did God cause a wind and a fire and an earthquake to take place before coming back and asking Elijah that same question? What's he doing here? What do you think, Scott? All right, good. So one, he's challenging Elijah to see a bigger picture, right? What else? What else could this possibly mean?
He's asking the worst kind of what's he doing. Elijah basically explains that I'm on my deathbed. I've done all this and I'm basically dead. And when we look at, you know, an earthquake, a fire, some of those are destructive things. And often people don't survive those things. Mm-hmm.
That's how I've read this, and I didn't know if that was accurate. That's how I've read this. And God is demonstrating His power to destroy and His power also to preserve. Elijah's still here. Elijah's here for a purpose. Elijah's here for a reason. And God is demonstrating to him who has the real power here. It is not Jezebel. It is not Ahab. It is God who has the power to give life and to take life. It is God who has the power over even nature. It is God who's the one who fed Elijah and clothed Elijah and brought Elijah to this place. And it's going to be God that's going to take Elijah from this place as well. And so he is challenging his perspective and he's re-emphasizing his power, not in a harsh way, a gentle way, but yet also a very bold and powerful way towards Elijah. And then finally, he tells him, your perspective isn't accurate. Elijah, I know that you feel alone. He doesn't tell Elijah, you shouldn't feel alone. But what he tells him is, you aren't alone. There are 7,000 others that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. And you know what each one of those 7,000 was having to do because of Jezebel? They were having to hide. They were like those other 100 prophets that Obadiah had hidden in a cave. You think they felt isolated? You think they were afraid? You think they were discouraged or felt alone? Elijah's emotions and Elijah's feelings were genuine. They were real. But his perception and thinking that I'm the only one was not accurate. And so God is not only correcting him, but also God is encouraging him. Because that's Satan's biggest lie that he wants to sell us in our life, is that you are alone. In your struggle with sin, you're alone. No one has ever done this. You must be the worst person on the face of the planet. You must be horrible. And Satan wants you to keep it to yourself and not talk about it, because he understands as soon as you confess that there's power in confession, that Satan no longer has over you. That there's power in understanding not only that confession gives you accountability, that confession often leads you to understand this truth that you're not alone in your struggle. You're not alone in this issue. And so here God, in telling Elijah that there are 7,000 others, is ridding Elijah of that bond he had placed on himself and thinking, I'm all by myself, because he wasn't. Yes, Scarlett. Right. 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 And luckily, God doesn't shake Elijah, right? He's very gentle with him, and he gives us an example of how we ought to deal with others and help others who are struggling. Because every single one of us has been maybe not in the exact same position of Elijah, but we can relate to what he's going through. We understand we've been somewhere like that before. And we need the patience and kindness and the gentleness of someone helping us and caring for us like God does with Elijah here. He offers a change of focus and perspective. And then, even more importantly, God gave Elijah something to do. So let's read the rest of this that we skipped over. Can I get someone to read verses 15, and go ahead, go all the way down through verse 18 again. 15 through 18. Secret from a teacher. That's why I have other people read it, because I can't pronounce those names, and so I make someone else do it. God listens to Elijah again, and then the very first words out of God's mouth is he says, "Elijah, go. I've got something for you to do." And I think there's something really important here for us to recognize. Often, and when people feel discouraged, and when people feel hopeless, or people feel isolated, it's going to be very difficult, but if they're willing to put in that tremendous effort to do something that's so hard for them to do in that moment, to give them a task, oftentimes when they're finished doing that task, it's going to help pull them out of that place that they're in, because now they have a sense of worth and value and direction. God gives Elijah direction again where perhaps he didn't feel direction. He says, "I've still got work for you to do. Your life is not pointless. You're not better off dead to me. I've got work for you to do still, Elijah." And so here he gives him a task. He wants him to appoint two kings, but also he has him appoint another prophet. And we'll talk about that more in just a second. But this is a huge lesson for us to learn as we develop people spiritually in the church. Because oftentimes, people can feel discouraged because they feel like they're not useful or helpful to the body of Christ. And generally, there's two groups that feel like that more often than not. It's those who are very old and those who are very young. Those who are very old feel like they're no longer useful to the body of Christ because their strength has left them. Their ability to do the things they used to do is gone from them. And so they feel like, I just fill a pew, perhaps. I've talked to many older generation who feel like that. And then the other side, you've got young people who feel oftentimes like they don't have anything to offer to the church because their lack of experience and because their lack of knowledge and their lack of wisdom, and they don't feel like they have anything to give or to contribute. Giving someone a job and making sure that they're plugged in and a part of the work, and even if you've got to go and ask them, "Hey, I really need your help with this," that can turn people around so fast in the body of Christ from feeling isolated and feeling like they're not contributing to feeling like they have something to do. They have a part to do, because everyone does. Every single person has a part to play in the body of Christ and the work that we have to do. Everybody. No matter how young you are, no matter how old you are. That's what Ephesians 4 teaches us. It's just finding that thing and encouraging people to do it. Sometimes people just need some direction and help in finding that. But we need to do better at getting people plugged in and getting them to work. And oftentimes it will pull them out of that fog. But not only does he tell them to assign two kings, he has him seek out Elisha. And this is my question: why does he have Elijah do this at this time? Because when we look at the timeline, when Elijah is finally taken up in 2 Kings chapter 2, there's 6 or 7 years that go by from this point until 2 Kings chapter 2 that Elisha is going to be with Elijah. So why does God have Elijah go and find Elisha right now? All right. Number one, Elisha's not going to get thrown in the deep end of the pool without learning how to swim in the kiddie pool first, right? Elisha's going to have time to be mentored by Elijah for 6 or 7 years ministering to him. So that's very important, number one. What else? Elijah was not going to be alone ever again. He was going to have Elisha by his side, and then he wasn't even going to see death. He was going to go straight from the side of Elisha to straight to the side of the Lord. Never again would Elijah have to feel alone. And I think the reason God sends him on this task right now was to help supplement what Elijah really needed after all this time. Because think about it, it's not just this period that Elijah's felt alone. After he commands Ahab that it's not going to rain, where does Elijah go? To the brook of Cherith. And from what we know, there's nobody else that's there with him. And then he's there with a widow and her son for, we don't know exactly how long, but the period that Elijah was not in contact with a whole lot of people was 3.5 years. And then he goes straight from there to this moment. Elijah needed some help. Elijah needed someone with him. This goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. It's not good for man to be alone. And though in the context that's talking about marriage and God creating woman for man, the principle still applies. It's not good for us to be alone. God created us to be with others, to be together. And I really think that's why he calls Elisha at this moment, because Elisha is going to go after Elijah, and it says, and assisted him. And this is going to take place for 6 or 7 years. And I'll just say this. Sometimes we don't know what to say. Sometimes we don't know what to do for people. But just being there physically makes the world a difference. Just so someone is not alone. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. Just sit there with someone. I remember when my aunt died. 5 minutes? Okay. I remember when my aunt died. She was 40 years old of a heart attack. Completely fluke. And I remember my mom getting the call and just falling on the ground and just weeping on our floor. And within 15 minutes, we had 20 people from the church, all of the elders included, sitting in our living room, not saying a word, just sitting there in a circle around my mom. I'll never forget that. And she'll never forget that. But they were there. And sometimes what we need is we just need someone to be there. And I think we learn a lesson here with that too. It's not good for us to be alone. All right, some applications on how to address feelings of isolation or depression in our lives as Christians. Number one, God responded with compassion and guidance. When you look at Galatians chapter 6, and we're called to bear one another's burdens, and I believe that that's even larger than the transgressions that are talked about in verse 1. If we're supposed to respond with gentleness in leading people that are trapped in sin, how much more should we respond with gentleness to individuals that are feeling isolated or hopeless or lost? When we bear each other's burdens, we must approach people not out of an attitude of judgment or disconcern, and thinking, you just need to get over it. We need to approach people with gentleness and compassion like the Lord did with Elijah. Notice that God did not rebuke him for being weak. I love Romans 14. When it does talk about the weak brother, it says God is able to make him stand. And so who are you to judge your brother? And so even if you're dealing with someone who you can perhaps see a clearer perspective, and you can see their fog, it doesn't give you an opportunity and a right to judge that person. It gives you an opportunity to help them to stand because the Lord can cause them to stand and give them the strength they need. Number three, God did not distance himself from Elijah or ignore him. Oftentimes when we don't know what to do for people, we don't do anything. And so we just kind of let them be by themselves and think they're just going to, you know, they've chosen to be in this position. I know some people do choose to remain a victim. I'm not disregarding that. But God didn't ignore Elijah. He didn't just assume he was playing the victim. He reached out to help him, and that's why we're called to hold each other up, to be together. And then finally, God did not emphasize or did not minimize his pain or just tell him to get over it. When we deal with individuals, you might not understand what someone's going through. You might never have been through anything like someone's gone through. But when you look at the characteristics of what love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not arrogant, and quite frankly, when we make judgments about someone because you just need to get over it, what's wrong with you? That's quite arrogant on our part to think that, you know, I've got it so much more together than you, because there might be things I've struggled with or that I don't see the right perspective or picture that they do. We need to treat one another not with arrogance, but with gentleness, with patience, with understanding, and not being rude towards others. All right, we're almost out of time. Damon already hit this earlier, but other lessons that we learn from this is preparing the next leader, preparing the next generation. Elisha gets 6 or 7 years of training with Elijah that is so pertinent and important. And part of what we need to make sure we do as a church is a lot more mentorship. You read Titus chapter 2 or 2 Timothy chapter 2. Both of those talk about training the next generation, training the younger women, training the young men. And that means we need to spend time together, not just in services, in each other's homes, doing things like we did last week at the fair when Aiden was there. And we start them that young, and you're training and mentoring people. That's the way God designed the church. God sees your struggle. You're not invisible. Oftentimes people can feel like they're invisible, that they've been forced into isolation, that no one sees them. God sees you, just like God saw the woman with the discharge of blood. She must have felt so alone. And yet God, in this story, He didn't only see Elijah, God saw the other 7,000, didn't He, that had not bowed the knee to Baal. And they probably all felt like Elijah, but God saw them. And something we need to do so much better of is what Jesus called, you know, when I was sick, you visited me, right? When I was naked, you clothed me. And they say, when did we see you? And Jesus says, when you did this to the least of these, you did it to me. Part of the lesson we must learn is in how to bring out and help people to recognize that they're not invisible, that we see them, we see their pain, we see their struggle, and we want to do something about it to help them. And then finally, last point, God can bring us from the lowest lows to incredible heights. I think it's amazing that where we read about Elijah here is at the base of a tree asking for God to take his life. And in a way, God does answer that prayer, doesn't he? Because when we get to 2 Kings chapter 2, God does take Elijah, but he does it in a way that Elijah never had to see death. The thing that he was so afraid of, Jezebel taking his life and that his life's just not worth living, God takes him up. And the next time we see Elijah is standing at the side of Jesus and Moses on the Mount of Transfiguration. God can take us from the lowest lows to the very highest heights if we'll trust in him and let him direct us. All right, any last thoughts or comments before we're done? All right, thank you so much. We will reconvene tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Thank you all.